Yeah, how's is there nice places to walk in Germany?
Yeah, just near us. There's I've been doing a lot of running and.
How's that going?
Super fun, man. Trying to do 100 runs this year, and so far, so good, I think.
100's a good goal.
But there's an infinite number of paths. Though I've been here for 4 months, and I started to kind of get in a bit of a rut, I was like, oh man, I've finally exhausted. And then I just started running by the river yesterday. I just ended up in this brand new place. I was like, wow, I'm actually going to miss this.
I'm sure you will. But surely it's always there, you know. Drumore's nice too.
Drumore's nice. I'm going to be very entitled, and I'm going to say the one issue with my Drumore running routes is that I always have to leave my house in the exact same way and go through the estate to exit out, and then there's multiple possibilities.
So you're not open to driving? You're not open to driving to Hillsborough Lake and just doing laps?
Yeah, I mean, I'm open to it. I guess I could just you've just added now a whole different dimension to the whole, I'm on a big chest kick right now, and that move you've just made there has opened up infinite combinations of the run could do. You've completely opened up the board. Yeah. You've put the car in the middle of the board, and the options are endless.
Yeah, you can see the machinations now. computing. Yeah,
exactly. All of a sudden, my computational powers have just came up with 70 new runs. It's amazing.
I'm enjoying chess as well. I'm lingering around that 450 area, yep. And I'm not happy with that, but it's where I deserve to be.
Bro, I lingered around the 300, and it's crazy to see. If you put in a little bit of work, it's fascinating to see.
You mean in terms of learning openings or end game, that kind of,
yeah.
A bit of study.
I'll be honest, I'm going to geek out on you a million percent for a second. I've just bought a chess book.
I hear that's good.
And the book isn't really a book. It's more of a series of, it's just heroin. No, it's a series of just famous games, and it gives you the positions, and you're encouraged just to play through them. And they have little notes on why they did each move. And so I did my first one this morning. I just played through a game, and dude, I have to say, I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I learned a lot just from their little insights, if that makes sense.
I don't think that's that geeky. I thought it was going to be worse. I really thought it was going to be worse. Or I thought it was going to be the book was going to be a pack of those little green pills from the Queen's Gambit.
Yeah, it's not really a book. It's actually just a bottle of Tranks.
Yeah. That was a good show. That was a really good show.
Mate, I flipping love that show.
And then, I don't know, people are for example, Magnus Carlsen's come out and been people getting involved with chess because of Queen's Gambit.
Has he done that? I know lots of people
I was I was disappointed because...
I'm disappointed in him.
Surely they want as many people playing as possible. Yeah. Surely he wants someone... he wants someone to be a worthy competitor. That's surely what he wants.
I mean, but let's be real. The more popular chess is, the more lucrative it is for everyone that's involved.
Totally. Indeed.
Man, indeed. I'm disappointed because I do quite like him. Didn't know who... here's the other thing. Didn't know who he was before the Queen's Gambit, so there's that.
Oof. Interesting guy.
Oof. Amazing.
Imagine
that
being
so
your life,
much...
though. Imagine being being your life. You crazy. Kind of discover that you are a complete prodigy at something that young, and then just seeing that through.
It's crazy how young he still is. I look at him and I'm oh my goodness! You've had a whole career here. What the heck?
I suppose for him though, where does it where does he go? Does he enjoy chess? I'm sure he does, but.
But it's the truth, though. If you're world champion for 10 years, do you really care about an 11th time? Or what is it? Do you want to have 20-year reign? I don't know. It gets kind of dicey to peak young, I feel like. But maybe that's just a cliche to say.
Yeah. Or what could he do that gives him more fulfillment? Or, I don't know. He seems to be playing a lot of chess, so he seems to enjoy it. I'm sure he doesn't really need money anymore. So
no.
He must be doing it because he likes it.
I was listening to a podcast with... going to say his name's Garry Kasparov, I think.
He's very famous.
He's a Russian dude, world champion. And he had an interesting bit on Magnus. Gary strikes me as being like, he's a bit of a bitter guy. Like, he, sorry, no, let me take that back. He's so hyper competitive that he can come across as a jerk. Like,
yeah,
he's in, yeah, like ridiculously competitive, which is why he has been able to do what he has done. But people were like, oh, you know, like Magnus Carlsen's the greatest of all time. And he was really butthurt by that. But he made a really interesting statement. He says, of course, Magnus Carlsen is the greatest of all time because there's no other possibility for him not to be. He's like, with every generation, the younger players are being exposed to greater knowledge and understanding of the game. So if the younger players are not the greatest of all time, then they're doing something wrong. I was like, wow, that's interesting.
So he was saying that effectively, like, there's
Gary Kasparov. You stand on the soldiers of giants, basically.
Because Gary Kasparov at one time was kind of seen as a bit of a Magnus Carlsen when he was younger. Yeah. So he was that guy.
Absolutely.
And then someone came along and usurped him.
Yeah.
So I suppose bitterness is probably an interesting way to put it. I'm sure Gary would probably disagree. But
yeah.
But
it's a game of chess.
It's probably true, but it's the rise and fall of kings. Yeah, but it's the same with everything. Like, it's kind of like, of course, everything should be better. It's like, you know, from things like public sanitation to, you know, like writing. Do you know what I mean? Like, we have so much more information now than we ever did. Especially like Gary Kasparov, when he was growing up, didn't have internet chess to practice with.
Goodness.
Do you know what I mean?
Or the computer. Look at all of the access we have just through one website. It's ridiculous.
But yeah, Gary didn't have that. But then there's probably benefits to that as well. You know?
Yeah. Well, he talks about, like, he used to just spend, and actually I'm reading Bobby Fischer's biography at the minute. I'm in deep, bro.
I love that.
And, you know, he talks about, like, just spending, like, days upon days at the board by himself. Like, just looking at what, like, playing against himself. And, like, Gary was saying, like, well, that's one of the things he thinks that the younger player misses, is there's a lack of creativity that you get by being stuck and bored looking at the board versus like, oh, now you have the computer algorithm and it just shows you everything straight away. You know, you kind of lose a lot of that journey process.
Yeah, it doesn't get that hardwired into you.
Which is very, like, interesting, I think.
Boredom is something where our generation's terrible at, really terrible at.
Yeah.
Like, for example, I love having a good old bath, do you know what I mean?
Oh,
like,
nice.
I love a wee bath, and I usually bring a book or two books, and I sit or I write in the bath sometimes. I just sit there for, like, I can be in there for like an hour, 2 hours, no problem.
Epic.
But then I was talking to Rachel about this yesterday, and she said, you know, like, I can't do it. I can't sit there for more than 15 minutes and not have anything to do. I think that's something that's probably quite symptomatic of our kind of generation, you know? It's like, you expect there to be, it's not necessarily, maybe not her fault, but like, it's something that people struggle with a lot, you know, always having to have something to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, boredom is it's a great way to motivate you to do something.
Well, that's the thing, you know, it's the classic, like, granny argument. It's like, young people these days, and then insert, you know, the rant. But I think creativity is in jeopardy if we don't allow our kids to be bored.
I wonder what the, well, my mum's very good at that now. Put me in the room with the books and the classical music. I was bored so much that I read every book. It was because my mum was a teacher, and she had a store, and she put us in the room and played, she had music on just when she was working or whatever. So it wasn't actually literally forced us in a room with classical music and books, but there was a store full of books that people in her class could have read. So we were stuck in there for 2 hours every day waiting for her to finish up because she worked very, very hard. So we didn't really have a choice. It was read the books or do nothing for 2 hours every single day. So we read all those books, right from like Lady Bird, like history books, the whole way up to, you know, your Harry Potter type books and that kind of stuff. But it was great. I read so much.
I think that's key though. Like,
I was bored stiff though. I was absolutely bored stiff.
Yeah,
and like, or the days over the summer, she used to bring us in over the summer when like they had to come over the summer to kind of clean out their classroom or like kind of get things ready. I don't know, there's a certain name for it, I think, but we used to go to, and there's like, you're in the playground by yourself for like 8 hours and you have to think of things to do. Yeah, there's good times though.
I listened to a Jerry Seinfeld episode recently, and
I love him.
He talks about his writing practice. Mate, you gotta listen to it, you'd absolutely love it. But he talks about like his one writing practice is that he like sits down at a desk and sets a timer for an hour, and he's two rules. The first one is you have to stay there for the whole hour. And the second rule is the only two things you're allowed to do is write or do nothing. And he says 9 times out of 10, he ends up writing.
He's so funny. That's class.
It's
good.
Solid advice though. Really solid.
And how's your writing going? Are you still like in a routine of that, or is having a wee baby, you know, or is Jess debunking your time, or
yeah. So
cause I know at home you would have had like, you would have got up very early and had like that time to write.
Yeah. So I still am up at 5, and the 5 o'clock get up has actually become more essential now that we have the baby, because it's, you know, your personal time has become kind of more and more sacred. And so it's just like a guaranteed way to get like a sacred hour to yourself, you know, to do whatever you want to do. The writing I have taken a break from for the next 7 weeks because I just finished the draft of my novel. And so
congratulations.
I wanted to and needed to take that break. And so I kind of loosely now just have like that 1 hour of like, I don't know, like a developmental hour. So whether it's like doing a little bit of chess studying or like reading a book or writing something different. But in this season, that hour has become a little bit more fluid. And whenever I come back to the novel, then that hour will be kind of put back into that. But it's all good.
That's fantastic. Congrats on finishing the draft. So have you submitted it to, is it like a supervisor almost who comes and reads it?
Yeah, so my super so is just having to like blast through it. God bless them.
That's amazing. It's like having a, like, you know, your editor, really.
Well, it's a great opportunity because I don't think you would ever even submit like a draft so early on to an editor.
No, you know,
it'd be like draft 5 you would submit.
Yeah, definitely.
So it's good, like kind of like we were joking about the chess. It's like a nice opportunity for someone to come along and show you where you're going wrong early on before you're too far gone. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. That feeling I do know about in chess, definitely. Oh no. Oh no. I should have done that.
Oh no, my queen.
I try very hard. I never resign. I try, and I know that's annoying. Unless it's like really like, yeah, I'm left with my king, I resign then out of courtesy. But I really try and play through. Like if I do something stupid, I just try and play through. Okay, like how do I fix this? Or because you're always going to have like someone good is going to beat you and challenge you that way anyway. So,
but even then, like even with your king, like the amount of times that I have stalemated myself trying to checkmate a single king is so embarrassing. So it's never over. Do you know what I mean?
No, it's good. It's good. I won a couple of good games yesterday, but it's just fun. It's I think it's more, instead of sitting there on social media, you're actually like giving your brain a little bit of a workout.
Yeah,
it's very worthwhile.
That's how I feel about it. Like I get a lot of fulfillment from playing, you know. It's and I don't know whether it's like placebo or not. Like I feel like I'm doing something relatively constructive in my time as well. Well, I think it's just the alternative. It's like, you know, it's better than sitting on TikTok.
Yeah, that stuff's just it's trash. Like,
oh, it's such a fun soundbite there. What was the last thing I was going to say? Yeah. I feel like at the very beginning, your only goal in chess is just don't blunder your pieces. Like if you can play a game where you don't accidentally give someone your queen, you're pretty much going to win if someone's on the same level.
Yeah, I'm just trying out different openings at the moment. Like it's like, or like, you know, defenses and stuff. I'm really enjoying that. Like just trying a couple of different ones. Like obviously I use the Sicilian first, or look that one up first, because it's the one that you keep banging on about in the Queen's Gambit.
And you're like, oh boy, I never mind.
Yeah. It's just like, okay, right, that didn't really help me.
They're like, but line 50, then if you remove this pawn, you're like, oh my goodness, nope.
Yeah. So I'm just trying different things, like openings and stuff. So it's good. Also just like someone who's playing with people who are better. So I played with you and you're all better than me. And I played with another guy who I'm friends with and he's better than me too. And even just like watching, you know, how you guys open or defend is interesting. But I used to go out with a girl in France and when I was over there, and I used to play with her dad sometimes. He would savage me every time. But he only had, he gave me advice. He would just say, it was really bad because you're trying to impress like the dad and stuff. So it's like, well, you don't really want to let him win, but you also don't want to like embarrass him. And obviously I had no chance of doing that. But it was like trying to put up a good fight was more where I was at. And he just gave me advice, and it's like, you know, if you attack and you put the other person on the back foot, they have to react to you. So never try and always be proactive as opposed to reactive. And
it's good.
It's very common sense stuff, but it's something I play with.
And mate, as all the big chess guys say, you know, as is with chess, as it is with life, it's good life advice there as well. Bit savage advice, but you know, life is pretty brutal. So let's just be real about it.
He was a good guy.
Look, I you know the drill, I usually start with kind of like an opening, like early memory sort of question. Mm-hmm. We have covered that in part one. And so I was trying to think, like, speaking of chess openings, I was like, what is this podcast opening? It's like, should I go for the Sicilian? Should I go for, you know, the Caro Kann?
Napoleon attack.
Yeah, I might go for the Napoleon attack. No, I'm actually going to go for the Tony Hawk opening. So my opening question to you is, what has been your most ever Tony Hawk moment on the skateboard?
He's a very specific type of skater. I'm not trying to be like nerdy here. Anything,
I mean, that's kind of why I asked it, because I wanted you to nerd out. So like, you know, even the fact that there's a specific type of skater is oblivious to me.
Yeah. So like, well, if you played the Tony Hawk games, Matt, if you had played them at all, you know that there's different types of skaters, like, or different types of courses. So there's
I played the games, but I don't remember that.
there's vert, which is kind of things like, you know, big, like half pipes and quarter pipes. So that would be known as kind of like vert skating. And Tony Hawk is like very much a vert skater, like really, really good at it, still going hard today. And then you have kind of like a more urban form of skateboarding, which is kind of called street skateboarding. And then before that, like what skateboarding kind of started with is a type called freestyle. And that's people who kind of like took the skateboards. They were surfing, and when there's no waves, they'd take the skateboards and they're kind of concrete surfing. There's a movie about it called like Lords of Dogtown, and people would, what they'd do is they kind of would start skating people's swimming pools that were empty in LA. So that's why skating swimming pools is really a big thing, because like they're kind of a natural bowl sometimes. So people would just skate them because it would be fun. And it was kind of like, you're recreating the kind of like cutbacks and stuff you have to do in surfing, but on concrete when there's no waves. And my most Tony Hawk moment, like, I'm not that good, man, but I would say I try, the style I like is the more kind of street stuff. So I like, you know, trying to use like ledges and wee bits of like transition, like wee ramps and stuff, and, you know, kind of doing like your kind of flip tricks and stuff. So there's a really good skate park in Belfast called Bridges. It's under the bridges that you kind of go onto the motorway near York Street.
Yeah, near the murals with all the famous people. Like there's a Simon Pegg one and stuff.
Corporation Street, I think it is. Yeah, and it's really good. So I think my most Tony Hawk moment is like there's a bit of like a manual pad in the middle. So you jump up and you're trying to balance. But I've done a couple of tricks off that before, that kind of stuff. So yeah, I don't know.
That's kind of like your... Oh, my fiance's watching, like, there's a GoPro on me, like, quickly, like, do the thing.
No, I skate as part of a group of guys. So there's a guy, Ross, who started this, and it's a club for, like, people who are kind of beginners, but a lot of people have skated before. Like, I used to skate when I was, like, 12 or 13. I got to the stage where I could do, like, a kickflip, and then I kind of retired because that was all I ever wanted to do. When I was like that age, I was like, then, you know, over lockdown, loads of us kind of just got back into it because it was a great way to get outside and, you know, just be outside and like have something like productive to do. Like a skateboarding sounds, I know people like think it's like anti-establishment or whatever, but like having a hobby where you need to rigorously practice because it's all muscle memory. Like if you see someone do something really impressive, they've probably done it like 1,000 times before. Because you have to practice everything, and it's just muscle memory, and over time your balance gets better and like your mind gets used to what you have to do. But anyway, Ross started this group of guys called it's Pepperoni Skate Club, and yeah, just a group of guys who are kind of just roughly the same level, although there's one or two guys who are just unbelievable. And then yeah, we just skate together. Like we're like the dad's club. We're like all pushing 30, and then we go down like 7 or 8 in the morning because like the park gets super busy at like 2 or 3 p.m. And then, you know, you can't really practice that much. So because we're all still like in that semi beginner phase, like the morning really works for us. And because some guys have like kids and stuff, or like one guy even works like a night shift or something, that kind of works pretty well.
That is such a dad.
But I love it. I love it. Classic. Yeah.
I was talking to my, brother-in-law who's younger, and I was like, yeah, you know, I don't know, something like I had a phone call with a friend at like 7 in the morning and he just went, what? He just couldn't get his head around that like two guys would like hang out with each other at like 7 o'clock in the morning. I'm like, oh bro, just you wait, like it's coming for you in 5 years. Like you're gonna be scheduling like 6:30s with your mates, like just you wait.
it's when the magic happens. It is really the best time of the day. Like, I am such a morning person. I think it's the best. But yeah, I love skating. It's been fun. It's just like, it allows you to get, I work full time, and obviously I'm working from home at the moment. So like, I spend like 18 hours a day in one room, because I work in my bedroom. So like, a chance to get out and do something like, which is like exercise, but it's also kind of fun too, you know, like, where I find a form of exercise I actually find fun. Like, I'm not a runner. I used to run a bit, but I just don't enjoy it. Whereas this, I really, really enjoy it. So yeah, having that, it's kind of like playing. My fiance calls it playing. And the first time she said that, I was like, it's not playing. Like, I'm a grown up. But then I realized,
I'm a grown ass man.
Yeah. But then I realized that she's totally right. And that's okay. Like, I do go hang out with mates and we go play around on like wooden boards. And that is amazing.
Well, I mean, it's funny. Like, I was actually writing this morning about kind of like the futility of running. Like, and I, you know, I'm really into running at the minute and I'm running a lot. But I was talking to my mate Nathan the other day, who you know, and I was like, I just can't wait to like play basketball again, because I miss like exercise that's a form of play. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, if only there was a way to like gamify chess into like a form of workout, I would be like the most ripped guy in the world right now.
I can see it now, some sort of like human chess where like...
Every time you get a check, you have to do 10 push-ups.
Yeah, every time, yeah, 5 burpees between every move.
Love that. So yeah, look, I'm just going to jump in and say hello. Welcome to Best of Belfast, to this rare and special episode, I guess, where we are doing something very, very different. We're doing a part two. Simon, I think this is the first part two, which is crazy. Like, it's funny, like, coming to do this with you this morning, I was thinking, like, when I got up, like, dude, do you remember the last podcast we did with each other? Like, that was donkeys ago. It was probably about 3 years ago, if not longer.
Yeah,
and I remember doing it in, we were renting a little 2 up 2 down on the Donegal Road at the time. And I remember sitting on these red sofas that weren't ours. I don't know whose they were. They came with the house, or maybe, I think maybe from our brother-in-law or something. And that was a turning moment in the podcast's history. Like, I know that sounds a bit dramatic, but I think that was the first episode I did where I really just had a conversation rather than an interview. And I clearly remember that episode because I don't think there was any like music or anything. It like was a turning point in the show. And so very, very fond memories of having you on the first time, and really excited to be doing this today.
I was so nervous for that. I remember like the whole morning, but like we did it quite early in the morning.
It's when you're at your best. driving over,
I was like, this nervous, what am I going to say? Like, I had like notes and all, like, if he asked me this question, I'm going to try and say this. Or because I was like, at that time, like, Turf and Game was still pretty much in its infancy, or like, it was starting to like become something. And I was like, oh man, this is big. I need to make sure I give a good account of myself here. I remember being really nervous for that.
You're like listening to Lose Yourself by Eminem in the car on the way over. You're like, come on, bro, come on.
Yeah, no, it was great.
Also different because, going to experiment a little bit with a new format today. I think it's the first time as well that I've asked a guest to like prep stuff, like, you know, like we've done our homework for this, and so like I'm really looking forward to it. So just to catch you up to speed, if you've just jumped in, Simon is a incredible guy, creative individual, holds down full-time job, has become a very good friend of mine, I guess, since we did the podcast. Our origin story, it always gets a bit blurry, but I think that certainly solidified our friendship, if not started it. And Simon was the founder and editor of Turf and Grain, which was an independent magazine. And in my eyes, like, it was really one of the most impactful creative projects in Northern Ireland of the 2010s. I don't know if 2010s has like a cool nickname, but the 2010s. And like I said, I think what was really impressive and inspiring for lots of people is that he did it all by holding down a really intense full-time job, which, as we'll get into, poses a lot of challenges as well as opportunities. And generally, if we're just kind of setting a rough sort of course for where we're going to go today, I'm really interested in hearing from Simon about how creative projects change us. I'm interested in why all good things must come to an end. As someone who does a creative project, who's given my life to Best of Belfast over the last three, four years, the reality is that this will come to an end at some point. And so selfishly, I want to use this opportunity to kind of learn from Simon and hear some of his kind of thoughts around that really hard decision to stop. And along the way, hope to do some highs, lows, learnings from this incredible journey. And the way that we've planned to do it anyway is we're going to take it issue by issue of the magazine, as they are kind of a bit indicative of different chapters of Simon's life. So, mate, just to start off and set the final bit of context that we need, in your own words, what was Turf and Grain, and why did you start it, if you cast your mind all the way back?
Yeah, so Turf and Grain was it began as a magazine about the people of Ireland. So we wanted to share the stories, experiences and ideas of all the people in Ireland that are maybe just like flying a little bit under the radar but are doing incredible things. And we had 5 issues, as Matt's mentioned. So the first one was youth, the second one was the outdoors, the third one was makers, the fourth one was women, and the fifth one was migration. So, you know, each theme kind of charted the kind of cultural moment in a way. Like, we tried to take a cross section of the kind of discussions around those themes, and, you know, let people who were kind of really like involved with each of those themes, or people who were really at the forefront of like those issues, like have a platform in their own words to express like what the kind of cultural moment in Ireland meant to them. And I suppose, so it's kind of like almost like a little kind of future history project, if you want to put it that way. It's like going to be kind of documentary style, but then also giving people a real platform to, like, you know, showcase their business or what they're doing. And the reason I did it was I kind of had harbored lots of aspirations about maybe moving away after I kind of finished my kind of formal education. But, you know, I went on a trip to Canada, and I was away for 6 or 7 days, and I really had a good time, but I came back and I just thought, like, you know, Ireland is great, and I've probably been just taking it for granted, you know, like the whole North and South, and maybe like I should stop looking around elsewhere. And, you know, why do people not just invest in where they come from? Because if you're from like Copenhagen or Tokyo or whatever, you know, people never really ask you, like, why have you come here? anytime anyone from another country ever turns up in Belfast, people are like, why do you come here? And it's kind of this, like, everyone's super humble, which is also what kind of makes us great. But at the same time, you know, I kind of felt like there needed to be a bit of a light shined on that. And, you know, just kind of showcase all the fantastic people that are just living and working in Ireland. And, yeah, does that answer your question, Matt?
Totally. So, I mean, let's jump. Let's go. We've been dilly-dallying, which is my fault because I love to dilly-dally. But if we just go straight in here, you know, episode one, you can see where my brain's at. Issue one. What was going on in your life whenever you were putting together issue one?
So, as you mentioned, I have a full-time job. I am a chartered accountant. And at that time, I was doing my training contract with one of the big 4 companies. But before I'd gone down that journey of becoming an accountant, I really wanted to be a publisher, like a book publisher. I had applied to a master's at UCL in London, and I had got accepted, but I couldn't afford the course fees. And I took a year, I saved, and because London's so expensive, I still couldn't afford the course fees. And at that time, there was no such thing as postgraduate loans. And I didn't really like want to ask my folks or any family for help that way. So, you know what? I just said, you know, is a piece of paper really worth, you know, £20,000-£30,000? And maybe it is. And but that time I decided that it wasn't. And I said, right, okay, I need to get a career. So I became an accountant. But after my first year, I was just really unhappy. I was just really unhappy. Like, I gave it my best shot, and I did work really hard. And I don't think it was a foregone conclusion that I would be unhappy. But I just reached the point where I was really just unsatisfied with, you know, you give up on your kind of dream, or, you know, you're not where you kind of wanted to be, and like all that kind of stuff. So I think, like, I lived in Canada when I was younger, and that's when I went to Canada, as I mentioned before. And I kind of was looking, okay, when I get out of this, like, you know, am I gonna maybe, you know, move somewhere else, or like, how can I escape? And I think it was kind of out of that, like, unhappiness, like, am I gonna try and escape somewhere else? And I also ended up, after my first year, I went to Portland, which is in America, Portland, Oregon, not Portland, Maine. And I did an internship with a successful publication over there for a couple of weeks, just following like a photographer around and doing a little bit of writing and copy editing and that kind of stuff. And I came back and was so inspired by them that I kind of thought, like, you know, like, why couldn't I do that? And that sounds really arrogant because these people are doing super well. Like, it was international. But then, yeah, I kind of thought then, like, you know what, like, you can't give up on yourself and so it's time to do something. But I suppose in terms of what was going on, I was working very hard, like training as an accountant, but I also just had this sense of, like, you know, I know there's something else here that I feel like I need to do.
Mm. So, I mean, give us why, or give us what exactly was going on in your life whenever you, like, started to put together issue one, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so like I said before, I came back from that trip to Canada and I just thought, like, you know, there's so much good stuff here and I need to double down on investing and, like, learning more about, like, the history of Ireland myself, because spending time out of Ireland as a child, I didn't really, there's loads of things that were lost in me, like even like the Protestant Catholic dynamic, which sounds crazy, or like, you know, the fact that there are like Irish sports and stuff, you know, I didn't even know about that kind of thing. So kind of like, so about learning the history, but yeah, so I just said, okay, I want to go and I know where I want the project to be based around, about the people. So I suppose I kind of was thinking, like, who do I know? Because at that point I would be way too afraid to to talk to anyone who I didn't know. I would never have approached, like, Gary Lightbody off the bat. Do you know what I mean? I wasn't in that mindset. I wasn't that confident because I had, like, major imposter syndrome about being like, oh, you are an accountant. Like, you have no right to be doing this the whole way through. So I started approaching people that I knew. So one of the guys ran a coffee shop in Stromilis called Indigo, which is no longer there, unfortunately. But when it was there, it was a great, like, community hub for Stromilis. It was like a gelato shop, which had a really great coffee bit in it too. Like, and loads of my friends are from there. And I went and I approached, the first guy I approached was a guy called Ryan who ran Indigo, because I was really interested in, like, a young person that kind of started their own business. And the theme of issue one was youth. So it was kind of about, like, what is it, does it mean to be, like, a young person, like, in Ireland at the moment? And yeah, so Ryan was a good example. He came out of, like, film school at Queen's, and then he decided to open his own coffee shop pretty much straight off the bat. And that really inspired me. You know, he was someone that I looked up to because I was someone who wanted to do my own thing, and he was someone who had already done his own thing. But again, I was so nervous to do that interview. Like, man, you have no idea. Like, I've done job interviews, which I was, like, way less nervous for. But yeah, so I did that with Ryan, and it was really great. And then it just started to kind of become a bit more real, I guess. Like, I started picking up pieces and telling people about it. And I suppose in terms of what was going on, the main thing that was going on, that everyone, like, I knew when I told them I'm going to make a publication and it's going to be about this, people are just like, that's not who you are. Like, you're not that guy. You're not this creative person who can do that. And it wasn't necessarily like they said it, but you could kind of see it on their face, or like,
right.
Yeah.
Right.
Let me know when it's done, man. Yeah. Let me know when it's done. Okay. Like, you're never going to complete that project. And that, like, it's, so what was going on? Like, you know, that really upset me. Do you know what I mean? I think, and this is something one of the things I've really learned, and something I've been thinking about quite a lot recently, is just, like, your mindset and why you do things. Like, do you do things out of this place of, like, positivity, or do you do it out of a place of kind of, like,
them.
spite or negativity, and, you know, or just, like, to prove someone wrong. And I guess, like, I was fueled a little bit by that. Like, initially it did come from this kind of positive place, like, you know, I'm going to back myself here. And then it kind of got discolored a little bit with the kind of, like, you know what, I'm going to do this, like, despite you. Because, like, people literally thought I was crazy, man. People thought I'd just gone crazy. Or people thought, like, I have, like, openly admitted that, you know, the times in my life I've struggled with, like, you know, depression and stuff. And I think people thought it was just an episode of that or something. So, and, like, people being concerned isn't a bad thing. You know, it shows that they care about you. But I knew this was something I really wanted to do, and I felt like I needed to do it. And yeah, I suppose that was what was going on, you know.
How do you get to the point, this isn't one of the stock, but I can't resist, how do you get to one, like, the point where, okay, send it to print? Because, like, I remember my first, I'm going to say my first, like, 50 episodes. Like, well, my first 20. Like, I would be painstaking over them. And I would be scundered by, like, the slightest thing, you know? If, like, something was out of place or I took a guest on a stupid rabbit hole, I'd be so hard on myself. And, you know, I think a lot of people can actually get to that point and then just hit the eject button and they're like, right, we're out of here, bye. So, you know, how do you, with all this expectation and this kind of opinion of other people circling around you, how do you ever kind of grow the balls to push that send to print button? Because it's never perfect, right?
Yeah, and if I would say that one thing about any of the publications we did, like, none of them were perfect. Like, there are typos in all of them, and the first one was particularly bad. You have to remember as well that, like, I didn't really know what I was doing, like, in terms of the write. Like, I could always, obviously, with an interest in books and literature, and I had written before, like, I knew how to write, and I could, you know, edit text, and I knew what I wanted to say, and I had the overview. But in terms of, like, graphic design, I didn't have a clue. I was, like, learning on YouTube, and I didn't really want to. At the time, I was getting paid like 13k a year because I was in a training contract, so I didn't have the money above my rent to pay for, like, you know, Adobe packages or anything. And so just doing it all super cheap, and then getting into the, I was desperate to get it to print. I was like the opposite of what you've described. I was really desperate to get it out there because I feel like, you know, the only person who really had expectations for it was myself. Mm. Like, no one else was waiting on it. Even the people I told, no one was waiting on it. They just didn't think it was going to happen. So for me, it was one of those things, like, you know, you can tell, and it taught me the lesson, like, you can tell people about something, but sometimes it's just better to show them, you know, like, wow. So when I actually had the first copies of Turf and Green 1 in print, sure, there's tons of, like, issues with them, like, some of, like, the images were, like, a little bit stretched or something because they weren't blown up in proportion, and, like, you couldn't do that, like, you can't do that with the naked eye. You need, like, most of the time you need, like, a bit of software to help you or something, yeah. Or like, just to keep you right. Are you using, like, guidelines or anything? I literally just did it by eye on cheap software. But, like, I think that's why it's become such a collector's edition, if I'm honest, because it's so, like, random and it's very raw and stuff, you know what I mean? Like, it's very, very raw, but at the same time, yeah, I was scundered by that, like, you know, like, some of the things being out of shape and stuff or whatever, like the odd typo and things, or just like, but I was desperate to get out there. And, you know, I think the positivity or like the sense of, like, you know, you actually did what you said you were going to do, was more powerful than, like, that sense of, like, you know, it wasn't quite what you expected, because I was in this place where, like, you know, I felt I'd given up on a career in, like, kind of, like, publishing and stuff. And, you know, I kind of just decided to turn the narrative around a bit and do something myself. So I think that sense of, like, you know, you're actually trying to do something was more potent.
This is probably veering in the realm of, like, abnormal psychology, like, counseling session, which is my favorite place to hang out. How do you, like, look back at issue one now? Like, if you were to pick up issue one in your hand, like, is it a overwhelming sense of pride, or is it an overwhelming sense of embarrassment, or is it an overwhelming sense of, what is that? Do you know what I mean?
I think even quite quickly afterwards, it was initially a kind of a sense of embarrassment, and I was very keen to get issue two out quickly because I knew I had learned so many lessons from issue one that I knew that I could immediately. I knew that, and also issue one, for some reason, a lot of people bought issue one, like, they sold out very quickly. And that was the most thing that's what's probably scummed me the most, because loads of people got it and, like, because they loved the idea, but then, yeah, like, why are the images, like, out of whack and stuff? So I was very keen to get issue
two. Shout out to the early adopters, man.
Yeah.
But that's the thing, the people 100%. Who go first, they don't mind things being a wee bit off, you know? That is the grace, I suppose, as well.
Yeah, and I think if you it's one of the benefits of doing it in Belfast, but I think if you tried to do that in, like, London or something, it would just never got off. It would need to have been, like, super high level spec before you could even get it off the ground, or, like, super underground zine type, which it wasn't. But yeah, I suppose, like, now I look back at it with a sense of, like, you know, this is where it started, or, like, that's where you were at the time. Like, you know, if you consider, and we probably get to this later, but if you consider where Turf got to, like, and where it began, like, you can only really benchmark against, like, yourself. So, yeah, like, I look back at it now with a kind of sense of, you know, like at least you did, you tried something, even though you weren't necessarily ready, you took the leap anyway. Like, you were brave and you tried, you know. And I think that's how I kind of see it. Like, and I believe me, no one, I don't think it's very good, but you know, I really just, I'm appreciative that so many people like took the time to even in just care that I did something, you know. Mm-hmm. That was really powerful. And the narrative changed very quickly from like friends and family and stuff, like from not being like, oh, you're not that person. But then like, you know, you have a launch at like, we had the launch at Indigo, that cafe, and all my friends came. Sweet. So you go from like, and then you're kind of like the center of attention for that one couple of hours or something, you know, and it goes from this thing of like, you're not that kind of person to being like, oh, well, you know, that is maybe that kind of person. It's funny how you talked at the start of the episode about how we want to talk about how I changed, but I think one of the most interesting things, and I have definitely changed, and I'm going to ask you that question as well. I'm going to flip that around on you, because I'm sure you've changed throughout the course of your project too, but my friends and family's perception of me radically changed after that.
That's huge. And that's the thing, like, you know, you are who you are until you become something different. Do you know what I mean? And it you do have to kind of give the people around you a bit of grace. Because you can get very angsty about it. You can get very, like, you know, Eminem, like, angry, ragey, you know, parents' basement sort of mode. But, you know, people come to expect who you are based on what you do. And so it's only whenever you change what you do that people are then like, ah, this is who this person is now, you know? And that's a very flawed way of looking at the world, but I think it's reality as well.
Yeah, it is a whole thing of, you know, not telling people like, oh, I'm going to do this, or I am this person. It's kind of showing them as well. But it's more important that you show you do it for yourself. Like, that is the most important thing.
It's the classic writing maxim, show, don't tell, eh? Look, I'm gonna move on. I'm going to pull an audible and just keep this moving, because I really like where we are. And so tell me then your approach to issue two. You set the bar out there, you put it out in the world, you all of a sudden have become a publisher, you know, you're like Neo at the end of the Matrix, like you've realized you're the one, and now you're flying off and you're ready for the next mission. So talk to me about that.
It wasn't like Neo at the end of the Matrix. He was very confident, and he knew that he could fly.
Maybe that's issue three or four then.
Yeah, I'd say that's more accurate. I think at the time, you know, issue one came out and it was really like, I was almost like, flipped. So many people wanted this. Like, people are like keen on this, or like they think it's good, and or like they like the idea anyway, because there's no way they could have actually thought the publication itself was good. So they like the idea behind it. And there was a lot of people started asking me, like, can I be part of this? Like, can I help you with this? And, you know, I think what I did differently was like, you know what? Like, if you want, I had a hard look at it and go, like, if you want this to be, you have to do it right. Like, so if you're going to talk about the people of Ireland, you can't just talk about, like, I lived in Stranmillis at the time. You can't just talk to people who live in, like, flipping Stranmillis. It has to be, you know, it's a whole island of people, you know. So I decided that I was going to be bold and just reach out to people. And I did that aggressively. And the best thing about TERF is that there's only, like, I think there's only been, like, one person who ever declined being in it. Like, everyone, like, so even at that stage, issue two, hi guys, I'm doing this magazine and it's about the people of Ireland, and we wanted to share stories, experiences and ideas in kind of like a documentary format. No one was like, most people were like, didn't even ask for a copy of issue one to see what it was about. They're like, yeah, sweet, and totally in. Like, people were so up for telling their stories, and I reached out to people who were like really, really impressive to me. So the approach was just that. So, you know, dropping people an email, and then it kind of worked a bit differently though. Like, I didn't plan out at the beginning. I talked to one person who then recommended someone else. And I took that approach because it was obviously, the second issue was about the outdoors. So the environment is something I care very passionately about. And, you know, so I kind of like, you know, I'm not really like a leader in the space, but the people who are will also know who else I should talk to.
Yeah.
So for example, I knew there's one woman I wanted to speak to who lives in Wexford. Her name is Mary Reynolds. And she was the first interview he did. Me and my friend Sarah drove down to Wexford one day, as you do. And we interviewed her. So there's a big Irish Heritage National Park in Wexford, and she had done a lot of work on that. So what she does is she's not really a gardener. She won the Chelsea Flower Show, right?
Wow.
But she is in the early 2010s. But she is more of like a, not like a landscaper is wrong, but she abhors it when people move the natural landscape. She is a rewilder. That is what she is. Ah. So she helped the Wexford Irish Heritage Park rewilded itself in a really beautiful way. And so we walked around there with her and we sat and we talked with her. And, you know, I met someone for the first time that was super passionate about what they did and someone who was not afraid to be exactly who they were. And, you know, who, but then they also really, like, they were trusting me with that power as well to represent them. And that was so scary. Like, sending the first draft to her of our conversation, like, written up, was really scary because this person, like, you know, this person's on, like, on the BBC regularly, like, having a go at the people in Gardener's World. Like, she's combative and fierce, but she's brilliant. And, you know, yeah, so I suppose, like, things like that, reaching out to people who are really impressive. And she referred me on to a couple of other people to go interview them. And by then, I also knew, like, the design needed to be better. So I did invest in the Adobe stuff and I started learning how to do it. I took a bit more time over it. And it changed formats. So the first issue one was kind of a square. And then issue two was a, like, kind of a slightly shorter than A4, but the same width as an A4 in terms of dimensions. Mm-hmm. And it's also, we began to print it on, like, really beautiful recycled stock. So the quality, the production value kind of went up a lot. And I knew it needed to go up a lot. And that required a lot of investment. And at the time, I wasn't making loads of money because I was still very much a trainee accountant. And yeah, I still poured everything I had into it, you know. And the approach was, okay, you've kind of dipped your toe in the water, now jump in. Mm. And that was how it was, you know. And I really did. And again, it's like people's perceptions of me or like did change a little bit. Like, oh, he's really going for this. Or, but it was interesting because at work, it was kind of like, it's not a good culture to have a hobby because you're working so hard all the time. Like, you're not working 9 to 5. You're working all hours and week classes on weekends and stuff. So it's not a good culture to have a hobby. And it's not necessarily a problem with accountants or anything, but it's just like, you know, people are like, oh, are you not focusing on your work or something? Which I totally was. I was doing both. And then, yeah, I suppose just like, you know, you're meeting loads of new people and you're kind of hanging out with new friends who are kind of a bit more like-minded because you're meeting people through it and stuff. And it was just a time of, like, you know, great change.
I remember, like, years ago, you gave an analogy of, like, some people like to do endurance running and run marathons. Some people like to go skiing and pour a lot of time and money into that. My version of skiing is turf and grain. And I loved that. Like, I don't know why. Like, that's, I remember that, like, all these years later because it kind of really resonated with me.
Yeah. Like, yeah, I suppose, like, my hobby, some people go jet skiing, right? And they spend their money doing that. And that was what I really wanted to do. That was what I was passionate about. And that's what I was willing to dedicate time to and resources to. And, like, I didn't have very much money at all. And, like, yeah, I really just tried my best with it. But, like, you know, when I think people really started to get the, you know, like, the message behind it as well. It's starting to, like, grow, like, okay, this is a magazine about, you know. And then this is more like stockist as well. People started to pick it up. Like, people did support the first one. People did stock it in their shops, but people really picked up the second one as, like, stockist and stuff. So it really started to kind of, like, grow. But I think at the time, I really didn't have, like, I was so desperate just to do it and not have it for myself. But, like, I was just to do it as an achievement and just to explore. Like, it was an art project at that point. It was really, like, an art project. There was zero profit motive. It was just for fun. Or, like, more than fun, whatever, like, fulfillment. And, yeah, that was more than my hobby. It was my passion, yeah.
What was the time gap between 2 and 3?
Very short. I would say maybe 3 or 4 months.
Mate, you banged that out.
I was so desperate, man. I was so desperate just because, like, not because the first one was, like, I just knew I could do better. And I was like, oh, if you don't kind of put something else out new that would be better, you know, you might lose the momentum or, like, you might, or I'll be like, I'll just be frustrated for like a year if I worked on it for a year. So I knew that, so I just banged it out. But it was great fun. But I'd started to believe a bit more in myself in it as well. Like, the imposter syndrome got a bit less as I kind of creeped into it a little bit more. But I did bang it out very quickly, yeah.
He's beginning to believe. I want to do a whole episode on The Matrix now.
Man, I'm here for that.
So that was the time gap between 1 and 2. How long between 2 and 3?
Bit longer. I'm going to say 6 months.
Yeah, still fast, man. What the heck? Wow.
Yeah, I think it just started to gather momentum. There was a bigger gap between 3 and 4 and 4 and 5 just because life got in the way. But yeah, that was the point where we were starting to really pick up steam, you know, and it was just like, not all consuming, but it was something I was just really, really passionate about. Like, I was when the fire burnt hottest for it, you know, like, I really just wanted to do it, you know. And
I have to say, like, I remember holding issue 3 in my hands and just being like, whoa, like, this is the real deal. Like, issue 3 for me is whenever Turf and Green, like, manifested itself into that Portland, Oregon style quality independent publication. Like, I think at that point, like, you achieved, like, what you set out to achieve in terms of, like, competing on that world stage, from my perspective, in terms of the high quality, both of the content, the actual production, like, feeling the Turf and Green paper is, like, unlike any other paper on the planet. I often joked, I think you called me out on it one time. I was like, yeah, there's this guy called Simon, and he makes this amazing magazine, and it, like, it's like holding, like, a work of art in your hand, and it costs like 50 quid. And you're like, no, that's not what it's about. But I often said that to people, because I was like, this is not a magazine. Like, this is like a piece of art. And I was just so, so impressed by issue 3. And that's the point where I was like, yeah, this guy Simon is like, he's doing it, bro. And he doesn't care if people are going to get on board or not. Like, this thing's happening.
That's pretty accurate. I didn't really care if other people got on board or not. And, like, sure, obviously, like, you know, it was a product. Like, we did sell it and it did go into shops, but it was never about money. Like, if I'm honest, like, total disclosure, I lost a lot of money doing Turf and Green, like, a lot of money. But it was my, like, you know, people spend their money going jet skiing or whatever, like I said before. Like, it wasn't, like, it was never meant to be a successful, you know, it was never going to try and list Turf and Green PLC, do you know what I mean? So,
yeah, man, we just floated our independent magazine on the stock market, bro.
Yeah, like, I think that you're right. It did kind of hit at that point. It did hit kind of start to get there in terms of quality. And yeah, it was really a lot of people's favorite is issue 3. I think a lot of people kind of, that's when it kind of hit home. A lot of people that, you know, it was just like something that was a little bit different. I think the difference between Turf and Green and other magazines is a lot of people like have magazines on their coffee table, and after a while, some of the magazines get like thrown out or something or recycled. And you don't, Turf and Green is the kind of magazine you just don't throw out.
I have them up in our podcast studio in Ormo Bass, and it's like, you know, they're out there to be displayed because they're not something that just lies dog-eared, you know, in a dentist somewhere. And part of that is it's the quality. Like, why did you put so much emphasis on that quality? Because that also is very expensive.
I guess just I wanted it to be the best it could be. And I think, obviously, the terms of the paper, like, I wanted to do it on recycled paper because at the time I thought recycled paper was actually like the most environmentally friendly medium. But it also, just because the paper was treated in a certain way when it was recycled, that it gave it this kind of different texture. So it was actually a really beautiful medium to print on. I don't actually think, from speaking to printers since, I don't actually think that, you know, recycled paper actually is the most environmentally friendly, because it needs to be treated to such an extent to get it bleached again that there's a whole process to get it there. It's probably not as sustainable as one might think. But I didn't know that at the time. And but anyway, the quality was important because, you know, these are people's stories, you know, these are people's, like, they really wanted to get it, their stories out there, like, there's their experiences. And I didn't want to go down the online route, and Turf and Green was never published online. And I know there's some stories on our website and stuff just to give people a flavor, but the idea was never to put it online or to kind of, like, you know, the way most media kind of attracts attention now via, like, Facebook stories or news feeds or whatever. And it was meant to be something that was meant to be purely enjoyed physically. And to do that, like, I think you have to have the quality where people wanted to pick it up. And it is, like, such a thing when you go into a shop to buy a magazine, there's a test where people would pick it up and flick it. I call it the flick test. So people pick up a magazine, flick through it, and they either put it down or they buy it. And that's, wow. No one goes into a shop and picks up a magazine and doesn't flick through it. The next time you go into a shop and pick up a magazine, you'll catch yourself doing it. Everyone flicks through it. And, you know, part of the quality thing is, you know, it passes that test. But then we're also, like, displaying people's, like, photography and illustration. And I didn't know if I was going to be able to ever do another one, you know. And it was just, I didn't really have a 5-year plan for Turf. I never had, like, rigorous goal setting for it. It was just like, you know, this is my art project. This is like, I want it to be like this, and this is how it's going to be. And
yeah,
you know, printing on that stock in that format. Yeah, it was really important.
What's your highlight of issue 3? It was Makers was 3, wasn't it?
Yeah, Makers. That was a really good one to make, because obviously I got to meet so many interesting people, and you know, the team got a bit bigger then. We started working with a really wide range of photographers and illustrators and stuff, and everyone was really like, it was really good like atmosphere around it. So I'd say the best highlight I have is we took a trip down to County Clare, and we stayed in Galway overnight, and we had a, like, you know, went out and saw Galway a little bit, and then the next day we went out to Clare to meet a guy who, he shapes surfboards, but he shapes surfboards for everyone, like of all abilities and stuff, and he's a really good guy. He's a guy called Tom Deutsch Harrison. He's an engineer, but then he also just like, his hobby is surfing and shaping surfboards, and he would shape boards for a lot of the guys that would like ride the big kind of slab waves that come off the West Coast. So like really, really impressive stuff. And we chatted to him, great interview, good fun. And then after that we kind of went out to the Cliffs of Moher, and I'd never been there before, and we managed to catch like the kind of sunset there. And you know, it just kind of felt like, you know, that was the feeling, you know, like, oh, this is so great, like Ireland is so great, and like we're doing something interesting in a beautiful place, you know, and we're doing, like, it's fun, and, you know, it's not just me, like, there's people who came with me, like, the photographer came with me, and, like, her husband came with me, and, like, that was just a great, you know, a great time, you know. And then the launch of issue 3 as well, where that was massive, like, we did it in the Naughton Gallery, and, you know, we had, like, Joshua Burnside came and played, on, yeah. He came and played at it, you know, and then just, like, people came, and they were super interested in it, and, like, all the people who like we partnered with, and like the different independent stores and stuff, were super into it, and like readers were into it, and just kind of felt like, you know, it kind of felt like a tangible sense of like people really got what it was, and that was the kind of highlight, you know. I think I felt really assured about that, you know.
I'm gonna also say, like, we really began as well, like, just mm-hmm. to jump in, like mm-hmm. such an impressive amount of people in that room as well. Like, I remember being at that launch, and I remember like selfishly leaving with like 3 or 4 podcast episodes like booked off the back of it, because the people there were so interesting. Really, yeah. Really fab. What were you gonna say, sir?
No, yeah, I think it was just the first issue when we, like, issue 1, I pretty much produced the entire thing myself. I took all the photos, I did most of the writing. There was maybe a couple of like friends helped me with different wee bits and pieces, pro bono, which is very good of them. And then issue 2, we kind of just, you know, it was kind of done, apart from the printing, it was kind of also done pretty much on the cheap, and people kind of came and helped, and I gave them what money I kind of could, which wasn't a lot. But then issue 3 is when we started to really, like, we paid people, like, and we paid people really well, because the sales of issue 2 had been quite good. So, like, we were paying, like, young photographers and writers and stuff who didn't really have many other platforms or was trying to get out there. Like, we're paying them, like, real money for, like, their work and stuff. And I think that's something I'm not like a patron or anything, but like in any means, but it's the right thing to do. And I knew I was doing like the right thing, and sure, I might be putting myself out a little bit, but like it was the right thing to do, and we were doing it the right way, and people were understanding it, and like it all kind of started to come together, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. What was the low light of issue 3? What was maybe the hardest bit?
Yeah, man, I think it was just like, I think like that whole thing about, you know, maybe putting myself out a bit, like I started to, you know, that issue, to get there to the sales of issue 2 had been good, and I never took a penny out of the magazine at any point. But that point I probably, like, to get it out, like we paid people really well, and we printed it, and we printed high volumes. And like at that time I was maybe earning like early 20s, still very much within my accounting training contract, early 20s kind of salary, paying rent, living out, paying for my car and stuff to get to all my different client sites and stuff with work. And I definitely overextended myself financially, you know. And I think there's a really fine line, you know, between being like devoted to something and then to being self-sacrificial. And I never, like, it's not something I ever told anyone on the team or anyone that ever read it. Like, I never put it out there, but, you know, it's something, and it was, I never would have wanted anyone to feel bad that I had paid them, you know, I never would have done that. But, you know, I kind of just justified it to myself by saying, you know, the sales of this one will be good and we'll kind of make the money back and stuff. And, but then I never took money out of the project. So I kind of just sunk loads of my own money into it. And I did definitely overextend myself, and, you know, that caused issues for me later down the line. And like, maybe it wasn't the smartest thing to do, but, yeah, so it's hard sometimes, because sometimes like people always say, oh, you know, issue 3 was the best or that kind of stuff. But there's times I had, you know, sleepless nights about like financial stuff, you know, to get out there. And that was probably the low light. But, you know, it's funny because when I look at the magazine now, I look at the whole project as a whole, it is sometimes a little bit like tainted by that, or like in a very minor way, or a bit like, oh, you know, some days I feel like you're an idiot, like, what were you doing? That kind of thing. Cause I don't know, it's, but then it's like I think you have to think about what all the things I gain from it, you know, totally. Because I think it's the whole thing, maybe in Northern Ireland, a little bit like this in terms of like state or something, I think I had bumped into a guy one day who I went to school with. I won't name him because he's a really nice guy, but he didn't mean to do this either. But he's like, oh yeah, I just bought my house. Here in Stremless. And like, and like, I should be like that. If I hadn't done this, maybe I could have bought a house. I wouldn't have been up to anyway. But so I'm on the wrong track here, and I'm being an idiot. And I suppose when I look back at it now, it kind of is, okay, you definitely did make sacrifices to do Turf and Grain. But at the same time, what you got from Turf and Grain also has worth too.
What have you got from it?
I've made so many mistakes that I've learned so much. Honestly, like, I think that's something I think about sometimes. Like, I don't think I'm particularly super intelligent person. I know people here are a lot smarter than me, but I would always say for my age, I've made more mistakes than by far than the average person. And that has given me, I think, a dose of wisdom and the real life experience that I can carry forward with me. It also gave me, you know, a real sense of responsibility for other people and their work and stuff, you know, like people are really trusting you. And I think like one of the things I noticed most with the contributors that I worked with is the sense of this is not a slight on them at all, but a lot of them are very insecure, you know what I mean? Yeah. And as I was myself, and I think just seeing people grow with confidence, you know, and like, you know, you've helped them in some small way, and without trying to make myself out to be better than I was, like the people I helped, that does give me a real sense of like, you know, it was worth it, you know, to help like give people a platform, and what you did was a good thing. And, but yeah, mostly the mistakes and learning from those, I think it's been the best thing. And yeah, I don't know. Also, I don't know if we talked about early adopters. My fiance was actually one of the people who came and bought issue 1.
I mean, so that's it right there. That's all you need to say. It's like, yeah, I just, you know, I got a wife from doing this project. So
That's what she says. She's not wrong.
And just on that note of kind of like, you know, people being insecure and imposter syndrome, issue 3 was the first time in my life I came across the term imposter syndrome. I think it was issue 3. I think there was an illustration.
Yeah, right. Issue 3, yeah.
That someone had done that was beautiful. And, some really great text along with that as well. And I remember being like, oh, that's what that feeling is. Thanks, Simon.
Yeah, so I think the person who, I was building the website at that time, and the person who did that for me was, her name is Danielle Morgan, and she is part of the Imposter Project, which is a project which interviews people in Dublin, and mostly women or entirely women, about, you know, the sense of having imposter syndrome in their industry. So it's the illustrator is Cleo Meldon, and then the writer was Natalie Marquez Courtney. And all three of them have done fantastic things, but them together, they run the Imposter Project in Dublin, and it's interviewing like high profile women about, you know, the sense of imposter syndrome and how they overcame it. And it was the first time I had ever encountered it either. So I thought it was, when I first heard about it, you know, I was like, you know, this is definitely how we need to open this issue, you know, like, cause that issue about makers was, it wasn't meant to be like twee, like, you know, well, it was meant to present like craftsmanship, and it was meant to really give a sense that people who worked as like self-employed, like, you know, makers of any kind, it's real work too. Like, because I think, like, for example, my dad, no harm to him, he's great. But I think he would have had a sense of like a photographer, being a photographer wouldn't necessarily have been like a real job, mm-hmm. which obviously is nonsense. So I had that kind of sense. So you might notice if you go through the issue, that I made sure that people took loads of photos of like people's hands mm-hmm. and like often actually at work. So for example, if like a good example is the guy who's shaping, Michael Scullion is shaping like a hurling, like, do you know what I mean? Like a hurley. And, he's actually shaping it for camera and stuff. And you see him doing the work and using his hands, and people, I don't know, like that kind of sense of, you know, this is real work and it's really hard, and but it's really rewarding too. And these are the kind of people who are kind of taking the risks to make, you know, Ireland a little bit special. And I think that was, hopefully we achieved that, you know.
And what I loved so much about it as well is that it, I think sometimes the hardest thing about being an artist or being an entrepreneur or, you know, anyone who's actively making something is it's the battle of the mind, you know, like you face the hardship of, oh my goodness, I have to do my taxes, or, oh my goodness, this business challenge. But really, you know, the underbelly to all of that, or the foundation to your ability to combat all those challenges is basically your own head, you know? And I like
that.
That
book, you lent me, the War on Art. Is
oh,
that right?
Mate, what a book. Crazy book. The other thing I was thinking of there was, and these numbers are not accurate, they're just indicative, right? It's more of a metaphor, but you know, you had that course in London that you were wanting to do for like 20 grand. And you think about like, what would that have given you? It would have given you the piece of paper, it would have given you, you know, this maybe skill and whatever. Or you could have spent, again, just metaphorically speaking, 20 grand on turf and grain, and look at the education that that gave you. So I think as well, like, it's, that's not something that we think about either. Like, we want a tangible output. We want like a, ah, yes, here is this Harvard certificate hanging on my wall now. But actually, that might not have been money well spent for you. Maybe you would have been better going and spend a lot of money on, I don't know, like a skateboarding coach, if those things even exist, because the lessons you would have learned doing that, you know, would have been kind of more valuable to your life. But yeah, just a side thought, just a wee throwaway.
That's a good one. I don't think I did a history degree. I'm not always sure that, well, conditional history is fun to read about sometimes. I don't really think in your own life it's a very good, having that what if isn't really, I don't think it's useful, if I'm honest. Like, yeah. So that's a very interesting thought, because I never thought about that myself. But I suppose if you think about that kind of indicative sum of money, which wouldn't be that inaccurate, is...
I was trying to protect you there, but if you want to go for it, let's go for it.
No, but it's more like, you know, it's the investment. And I mean, I'm proud that I invested it in, you know, the kind of, you know, trying to make in some very minor way, you know, Belfast or Northern Ireland or Ireland a kind of better place, or change the mindset around it. And I think for me, it was a worthy investment, because I think in some senses it succeeded.
And look, let's stay on money for a second, right? Because, you know, you're an accountant, we're allowed to do that. I read a really interesting book recently, which I actually should give to you. It's called For the Love of Cities. It's by a guy called Pete, not Scazzaro, that's somebody else. Kagi Mana is his name. And he talks about how, like, as cities, as like city councils and government, like investments of relatively small pots of money into creative communities have huge return on investment. And he talks about, you know, people being part of the creative class in the city, and people who are makers and people who are kind of community champions. And by throwing just a little bit of money their way, you could have endless results in your city. And it's funny, because, like, if you think about it, like, if you think about it, and this is not a bash on anybody, but if you think about, you know, various pots of 20 grand that are spent on things for Northern Ireland, I would say very, very, very few of them, if any, were able to produce the quality of output in terms of connection and bringing people together and a sense of purpose and place that TURF was able to achieve. So we can say it's a lot of money. And on one hand, it is a lot of money whenever you're a young guy putting a lot of it in. But even in a grander scheme of things, you're like, mate, this was a bargain for what we got for it, if that makes sense.
I've never thought of it as a bargain before, but that's...
you're like, don't you dare ever say that to me again.
But that's, I like that. I do like that. I think you, yeah, that's very flattering for you to say that. So I appreciate it.
Issue 4.
Mm-hmm.
Hit me.
Issue 4 was great.
Is this like a classic hero's journey moment where like issue 4 is like where like things get really tough? Like, is this where like honeymoon period and your marriage is over and now you have to really like start to put the work in?
No, like I still really had a burning desire to do it, but I at that time, I suppose, like what was going on in Ireland was there was a lot of discussion around the Eighth Amendment, which relates obviously to, you know, abortion. So there was a lot of discussion around that, and I felt like, you know, at the time there was a lot of, it's just on like social media and in the mainstream media as well, like there was a lot of polarization, and polarization is something that's obviously very, you know, it runs concurrently through many different issues. But especially in this, there's very pro and very anti, and there seemed to be very little dialogue within the middle, just as an outside observer. And also, you know, exploitation of women, or this, the fact that women don't feel safe a lot of the time, or that most women have been, you know, victims of like sexual assault or harassment, and just like, you know, the gender gap in terms of pay and, you know, or opportunity. There's so many things, and I thought, you know, like this is something that I have the power to at least like not to discuss or like be an opportunity to reach into, but not for me to do it personally, to do it, to empower other people to do it.
To facilitate it as such.
Yeah, because I felt like it was a discussion that needed to be had or could be useful, or that's something that I would find beneficial myself as a user. So yeah, it was also, so that was something that was not something I didn't really want to cede control, but I realized that this issue was the one that we really needed, or the one we really should do. And I think that was that's a moment I'm probably most proud of. It was a time where I was like, you know, Turf and Grain has gone beyond my thing to being our thing. So I'm not going to be the editor of this next issue, and I'm going to hand it over to someone else. And I'm very proud that still today that I was able to do that and not meddle, because I didn't meddle. I proofread everything at the end to make sure it was Turf and Grain's kind of style. But one of the most interesting things about that was, like, you know, we went away and we did the issue, and it was a really powerful issue. But one of the funny things is that while we didn't lead anyone down any path to talk about anything, people, like women, were just, each woman who was interviewed, all amazing people, were given the opportunity to talk about anything they wanted. And no one mentioned the Eighth Amendment once.
Wow.
No one mentioned it once. And that was just so, like, there's no sense of, like, we need to go back here and capture this to be, like, relevant.
Yeah.
It was more like, this is something in itself, you know, this is really interesting. Like, you know, maybe people are tired of it or whatever. Like, but the different stories that we got were just amazing. And it was, like, it was good to hand over to, you know, another editor and stuff. And I think the thing that sometimes frustrated me was that maybe, and this isn't necessarily relevant to this one person, but, you know, sometimes people would write something for you and then you'd kind of give them a bit of constructive criticism, and sometimes they'd maybe take it a bit badly or something, or like, yeah. And you'd be like, you know, I'm really trying my best to help you here, or like, you know, don't take it personally. I'm just trying to get like the seasons to be speeds to be Turf and Grain and stuff. But yeah, like that was a really interesting issue. We did a kind of a flagship moment, and we had a big photo shoot on White Rocks Beach. We had like models for the first time. We'd never done that before, and we had actually done like creative direction around like the cover and stuff, and that was the first time we had done that. Like, we had actually, the cover for issues 1, 2, and 3 was a photo selected from within the book, but this time it felt like, you know, we really want to make a statement. Like, we want to have, like, you know, like, and what the statement that was decided upon by the kind of creative group was, you know, we wanted to have like 4 or 5 women, like, you know, on a beach, like kind of confronting the camera a bit. So like they're kind of, you're tapping into kind of like the natural and environmental element of it being rooted in Ireland. So it was taken on like a very rainy crap day. So I still feel sorry for the models. He probably froze themselves to death on that shoot, but right. Kind of a crap rainy day, wearing beautiful linen garments from 31 Chapel Lane, who are based in the south of Ireland. And they're kind of like confronting the camera in a kind of way, which is like, you know, we're here to say something. And that was really powerful. And that that one thing kind of felt like it took us to the next level. Mm-hmm. Like, we're going from kind of having this kind of reflective stance on what's going on to having this proactive, like, what are the issues we want to talk about now? And that was a really big step, I think, for us. And the team pulled it off really, really well.
Was it harder for you to step back than to be involved, or what was that like?
Well, work was very, very busy. So at this point, I was kind of coming up to my kind of near my final exams, which is very, very tough. Anyone who's done the accountancy exams will, or any kind of professional exams will know you're working and you're studying for those. It's very challenging. And in some ways, I was very busy doing that stuff. But then I really trusted everyone, you know. Like, there were some times, like, there were some, like, really understandable but kind of minor disagreements between people within the team, and that's something I find really difficult. So, for example, like, on the day of the, without naming any names, on the day of the photo shoot, it's kind of like a no-no for someone to take out their phone and take a picture if the photographer's kind of set it up. Do you know what I mean? Because then you're kind of like, the photographer's kind of done all the work, and then someone else will come and take a picture, and it just found its way onto Instagram. And
oh no, turf,
yeah,
drama.
Like, yeah, so, like, just a little bit. But then that was like the first time I actually ever had to have a conversation with people where I had to be like, you know, that's not okay or something. And I went from this kind of, you know, it was all very fun to something that kind of felt like a lot of people were quite upset about it. Do you know what I mean? And I think it was handled well in the end by everyone. But, you know, it was just that kind of stuff where, like, people started to really take it seriously. Like, this is really important to me. Like, Turf and Green is very important to me. And they wouldn't have been so upset had they not been. And I don't know. I found it, like I said, people took it so seriously that I found it sustained itself quite well. I didn't need to be involved doing everything. I kind of more facilitated and organized things. And that I was able to be kind of thoroughly involved and checking on people. But in terms of writing the content, I didn't feel like it was appropriate for me to be really writing anything. So, it wasn't that hard.
It's great. And this is a question I never actually thought of asking, but did you know issue 5 was going to be your last issue? Like, going into it?
No, I think there's a big gap between issue 4 and issue 5. Issue 4 did okay. Issue 4 sold, like, it was a fantastic issue, and I feel like it probably undersold based on how good it was. Like, it sold in amazing places. Like, issue 4 sold in, like, the one of our stockers was the Museum of Modern Art in New York.
Crazy,
and like,
bro.
and then we sold it in, like, there's 3 places in Tokyo that sold it, as well as, more importantly, like, 30 odd places on the island of Ireland, which is most important. But, like, so it was really well received, and I think some people have told me that they really, really value that issue. But it cost an extraordinary amount to make. And it didn't pay for itself, let me put it that way. So that's why there's a big gap between issue 4 and issue 5, because I had to rally my finances to go for it again. And then issue 5, you know, there's a lot of things were going on. Like, I was now kind of in a serious relationship and stuff, which was great. And my fiance Rachel was very, very supportive. And she was a major part of the Turf and Green team, something she never really, I don't think, has got enough credit for, how much she really did. So I'd like to give her that credit right now.
Shout out to Rachel.
Yeah, thank you.
Hope the COVID regulations allow you to get married.
Yeah, likewise. But yeah, you know, then we decided to go down the route of like a Kickstarter. And when we did the Kickstarter, the idea wasn't that we were just going to do issue 5. The idea was that, the reason we did a Kickstarter was because I had repeatedly overextended myself and put myself in trouble, like, not like major trouble, but like, not in a position where you want to be as a 20-something-year-old. And I kind of got to the point where, like, me and Rachel had talked about it, and it's got to the point where, like, you can't do that again.
Yeah.
Like, you, and I was totally 100% accepting of that.
You're like, so I said, you're like, right, I know.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I just kind of, yeah, and then so we did a Kickstarter because, you know what, like, we felt there was enough community around it that we could kind of relaunch the project. So the idea necessarily wasn't that it was going to, issue 5 was going to be the last one. We had hoped that a Kickstarter would fund issue 5, which would then fund issue 6.
Which would then fund issue 7.
And we had other ideas. Like, we had considered maybe going down like a route of like carefully considered paid partnership, like advertising, not anything to do with text, but more images and like placement of brands that would be like because we needed more revenue, really. Just to fund the cost of production. And we also made a standard amount that we paid everyone for issue 5, because issue 4 and issue 3, I paid people like the professional rate. Mm-hmm. I paid people the professional rate out of my own pocket, and that was great. And I'm glad I did it, but it wasn't really sustainable, because the issues were costing, you know, 10 grand to make each one.
Yeah.
And this is a lot to shell out, you know. So issue 5, we'll do a Kickstarter, and we'll pay everyone a standard amount. Everyone gets £100 for an article or a photo shoot. And maybe that's not the professional rate, but, you know, this is an art project.
Yeah.
It's what we have, and it's an art project. And I still feel like I was doing right by people to pay them a little bit. So yeah, then what happened with issue 5 was a great, I think issue 5, really, it's the kind of thing, it breaks my heart a bit, because issue 5 I think is so good. I think it was just like, it's based on migration, and, you know, so we're obviously talking to people who have come from different countries and have made Ireland their home, and people who are really doing such amazing things to like make Ireland a more diverse and more beautiful place and a more accepting place. And, you know, we're speaking to people from like the traveling community, or, you know, people from just like really interesting perspectives. And, you know, coronavirus has came along literally the week we were to launch, and, you know, it's all with all the shops that we would have sold in closing. Like, you know, our sales were just terrible of issue 5, and it breaks my heart, because I'm literally sitting in a room right now. I'm not asking for anyone's sympathy here, but I'm sitting in a room right now with about 600 copies of issue 5, you know, and that, if that, like, you know, we sell each one at like £12. So, you know, that's an issue. There's an issue sitting in my bedroom. If someone, like, you know, if people were to buy those, we would have enough money for another issue. But then there's kind of like, so COVID happened, and also I'm getting married in May, and we're kind of thinking about like my 9 to 5 has never been 9 to 5, and it's not showing any signs of getting any less busy. And I'm also starting to get tired. I've been working very hard for 5 or 6 years, and I'm starting to get tired of having 2 jobs.
Yeah.
It's a lot. There's a whole energy thing as well, you know? So I just had a conversation with Rachel, you know, about just, earlier this year, or sorry, this 2021 now, earlier in 2020, you know, maybe late summer, kind of thinking like, you know, okay, how would we do issue 6? Like, how does it work? And then we kind of said, you know, do you really want to be spending like the year leading up to your marriage, or the first year of your marriage, like working 12 hours a day, 6 or 7 days a week, you know? And also, you know, sales with COVID have just been that poor that you'd probably have to be in a position where you might need to even initially put some money back into it. And again, that's something that was kind of our golden rule. Like, Simon, you're not going to invest any more money in it again. And it was really hard, but we just decided, you know what, like we could wait, and we could scrape together the money for issue 6, but we might not produce it for 2 or 3 more years. And then at that point we might lose momentum, or, or we'd be like doing a disservice to ourselves, like financially, by kind of breaking the one rule we had. And it was just like, you know, why don't we just go out on a high? And issue 5, you know, it really was. And not just because of the product, like the publication itself, because it was beautiful. And I'm so proud of like every member of the team that contributed to it. But it was more like the fact that we had really been building like a community around it. Like, we had got a team in just before we did our Kickstarter for issue 5. And the idea was that it would be less responsibility on me, and people would kind of take ownership of things in the team. And so there were 10 of us in the team, and people really did like take ownership of it. People were organizing like swim clubs and, you know, book clubs, and really, and like, we had a Christmas market like in 2019, which was just one of the main highlights of the whole experience for me. It was really beautiful. Like, and people had really started to become like an actual community, like, or like more like a movement than just a publication, where people were like really like showing up for things they cared about here. And I suppose that's the most heartbreaking thing, that kind of had to end. But ultimately, when I look back on it, it was just the right decision, because, you know, all good things do have to come to an end. And we had kind of set clear expectations for, like, you know, if this situation arises, we're going to walk away from it. And then those kind of things were triggered, and then we decided, right, okay, let's go out on a high here. And like, we did go out on a high. So, it was hard, but I think it was the right thing to do.
I can't underscore this enough. Like, I feel like we as a people and we as a culture, we're very harsh on ourselves. We're very harsh on each other. We're very quick, I think, to say like someone has failed or someone has given up. And the reality is, like what you've just described was probably the hardest decision that you could have made in the whole kind of like equation of possibilities. Because like that sunk cost bias or that sunk cost fallacy, like if you invest not only a lot of money but a lot of time into something, it's incredibly hard for us as individuals to walk away from that, no matter what that is. Like, it applies to every single areas of our lives. So like, how were you able to walk away? Because like, from an outsider perspective, like I think that was nearly an impossibility for you to do.
Really? For me, it just felt actually, it felt very logical. Like, it kind of was one of those things where, like, you know, your heart says one thing and your head says another thing. Like, my heart really desperately wanted to continue, like, but my head just said, like, no. And I think it's just because with issue 3 and issue 4, I had kind of overextended myself. I'd been burnt twice before, you know. Like, I'd been as very low between that, because sometimes, like, you know, it's not just about the money, it really wasn't. But, like, you'd be sitting there and at a launch and everyone, like, the launch of issue 4, I remember it really well. Like, you're there and everyone's telling you how great everything is and you're like, oh, like how great the publication is and stuff. And that is all true and all great and stuff. But then you're sitting there with a big, like, black hole and you're just like, oh, right, I have to sort this myself. And, you know, when the night fades, you're just like, right, okay, now I'm alone with this for the next 6 or 7 months while I figure out how to pay this back or that kind of thing. And I think it just because I had those experiences before. Like I said, I'd made many mistakes and I've learned wisdom from that. And I think it was just having that kind of good conversations just about, like, you know, what are the events that would happen which would, like, make you walk away from it.
Yeah.
And having that kind of, having those parameters set so that, you know it's the right decision objectively. And it was objectively the right decision because, yeah, like, I had achieved everything I always wanted to from it. Like, you know, when I started issue 1, you know this from yourself with your project, which is just done so well. But like, when you start it, you don't know where it's going. And you just, like, you do it because you have a hunger for it and stuff. And yeah, like, issue 5 was far beyond my wildest dreams of what issue 1 I ever thought it would become when I did issue 1. You know, like, my initial goal was to have it stocked in the coffee shop in Stromilis 5A. That was my initial goal, you know. And brilliant. Then, and we went from that to stocking it in, like, the Museum of Art in New York at the moment, you know, like, and that's where it got to. And so I got to the stage where I was thinking, like, you know, like, not that I've achieved everything I want to achieve with this, but, like, you know, relative to, if you're benchmarking against your initial goals, like, you've already done everything you wanted to. And I got, like, emotionally, and got out what I needed to from it. Like, it did change me to being the kind of person I am today and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, it wasn't easy, and telling everyone on the team that it was kind of over was really, really hard, because, like I said, people really brought a lot to it, and they really, like, of themselves, and it really gave people something, you know, to work on, to do and to express themselves through, and a bit of community. And I felt really horrible because I felt like I was taking the community away from them almost,
yeah,
if you like.
Yeah. No, yeah. I'm still so impressed by the maturity in that decision. Like, I think there's a Chinese proverb, I'm going to butcher it here, but it's like, it's about playing games. It's like, you know, before you start playing, always make sure you know the rules of the games, how much it costs, and then when you're going to walk away. It's probably like a gambling sort of thing. But I think, like, so few of us kind of have that in our head, you know, and it is that sort of like, oh, maybe if I just do this one more time, like one more thing, like, you know. And then I think that's where people can get themselves into really serious sort of issues, whether that's financially or emotionally or psychologically or, you know, whatever.
Was not Einstein who also said, though, that, like, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results?
Well, that's a zinger. Yeah, that's a tough one.
Yeah, but that's kind of, it crossed my mind, you know, at the time. Like, you know, you're just going to do the same thing again. It's going to kind of have a different result. And yeah, like, there's so many I don't want to be negative about it because there are so many pros, and I think I'm someone who really struggles to like look back on stuff positively. And it's not because I'm like a really negative person or I'm struggling, you know, or anything like with like my mental health or anything. It's just, I'm just not that kind of person. I'm not someone who rests on their laurels. I'm not someone who...
That's what I was going to say. I think because you're so future minded, you're kind of like, okay, you know, that we're done with that. Let's on to the next thing, you know?
Yeah. I think people find that hard. Like I was chatting to a friend on Saturday and he said like, you know, it was like, oh, you could have like, you don't really big it up very much that you ever did turf, you know, like you don't ever like, it's not even like really on like your LinkedIn bio or anything. And it's like, you know, I just don't like think that way. I just don't ever think of like leveraging it for something else or like.
Bro, you got to get a turf tattoo, man. Come on. Come on. Like on your butt or something like that wee turf logo.
But yeah, like, I guess it's just. I just don't think that way. Like I do look back on it sometimes and be like, you know, that was so great. But it's not often. I don't look back on it and think, you know, oh, like I'm so great. I did wonderfully. That was really successful. Yeah. It's not that I don't think that. It's like, I just never crossed my mind to think that way. But I think sometimes I still get it all the time. Like, oh, you're the turf guy. And it's like, oh yeah, like that's, sometimes I open a copy of an issue 3 or 4 and it's like, oh yeah, we did that. Like that happened.
Yeah.
It's like you forget, you know, like, or I'm a different person now than when we did that. And I'm sure like, well, how do you feel about that? Do you not feel the same?
I mean, like this is kind of like what I wanted to talk about because there's sometimes like I'll watch a movie and a movie almost becomes like a little time capsule for me because it reminds me of like what was going on in my life at the time. Actually, even better metaphor, I interviewed an amazing woman called Natalie and she was a puppet maker and she makes like stop motion puppets for like Tim Burton and Wes Anderson. Mm. And that's such a painstaking process. Like, you know, you're like with stop motion, you're putting in like, you could put in like 10 hours of work for like 1 second, you know, it's ridiculous of screen time. And she says whenever she watches those movies, she is reminded exactly what was going on in her life in every scene because it was kind of encapsulating like a whole chunk of her time. And for me, like whenever I like flick through like the Best of Belfast back catalog, you know, the 200 episodes, I can say like, oh yeah, like episode 20 to episode 30, like this was going on in my life, or like this reminds me of like how this episode made me feel, or oh my goodness, this was such a struggle to get this one out there, or I was so surprised by that one. And they kind of become like a little bit of like a creative diary in some ways as well. Mm. They remind you of like who you were and who you became and how you've changed. And so like that's what I'd like to know as well. Like we've talked a lot about how your creative project has changed other people. But like how has it changed you? Like how has it developed you? Seth Godin has an online course called the Alt MBA. And I remember hearing something, I think it was from Tim Ferriss. He was going to go and do an MBA and spend $100,000 or whatever it was. And instead he invested $100,000 in some startups and like taught himself how to invest. And, you know, it's the back to that idea we talked about earlier. It's like a different type of education. It's a different way to develop yourself. And I think creative projects, while we do them for a purpose for other people, I think that along the way we get immensely shaped by them too, you know?
Yeah, I think it is interesting. Like, I think it's really hard to put a finger on it. Don't know how you feel about that. Like, do you feel like you can say exactly how you've changed? I think obviously in terms of like some real practicalities, like in terms of, you know, designing a magazine, I'm much better.
I'm a wizard on Illustrator now.
No, I can't do Illustrator, but I can do like InDesign and Photoshop nice. Very, very well. Or like even, you know, the working with people, or like, I think the big thing is probably like responsibility for other people's time. That was a really big learning curve. Like, not like I was rubbish at it, but like I was very lucky to never have any like haters or trolls ever. Like never. Or maybe they did and I never saw it. But the only time I ever got it was, only time I ever got like constructive feedback was like, you know, be careful with like people's work. And it wasn't necessarily like I'd necessarily done something wrong, but people was like, oh, you have a real sense of responsibility here. Like you should feel very responsible for these people's work when you publish this. And I said, oh yeah, well, you're right, I do. And there are times when people like, you know, we rush to get it printed and like someone's illustration was necessarily not like perfect or something. Like it was kind of maybe like a little bit tiny bit pixelated and stuff like that, and you feel terrible. Like there's like, I was chatting to a friend recently and they said I spelled their name wrong and I never noticed. One of my friends Jane, who's classic. Jane's a really wonderful artist, and I think you go check her out, Jane Henning. Yeah, I spelled her name like Janye, like Janye West.
Mate, that's a new stage name. Come on, that's
a
gift.
To be fair, Jane's so nice that she can have a laugh about it. But I feel it's like one of those ones you just feel terrible. Like you're sitting there and you're like, oh man, like that was so bad. And what I've learned, like, I just know who I am a lot better. You know, like. I feel like at the time when I started, and maybe it's just the fact that I was in my early 20s, I didn't feel like I had a sense of purpose. You know, I was really trying to grapple with that, you know, like, oh, I gave up on this, and now, you know, I give up on this, now I'm doing something. And I feel like I'm not the kind of person who gives up on things anymore, you know, and I also feel like I learned so much more about, you know, people here and that kind of stuff. Like, I think one of the quotes I kind of gave you last time, which I was proud of, was, you know, like, the grass is always kind of greener on the other side unless you water what's around you. And that kind of sense of, like, you know, investing in things here and that kind of stuff. But I think even just in terms of my mindset, I've changed a lot. Like, I think I'm a lot less, like, I'm not, like, bulletproof, but, like, I tried something. Like, I really tried something. And no matter what anyone says about the quality of the magazine, like, I really just tried something for myself. And regardless of the result or if people think it's successful or not, I did it. Like, you know, and that is, if I have something I'd like to say to someone else or like pass on knowledge to someone else, I would just say, you know, really just do your own thing and really just go for it. And like the whole thing about, like, you know, telling people you're going to do something or telling yourself you're going to do something, like sometimes you just need to show people or show yourself that you can do it. And that is so important. Like, I don't know, and just like mindset around, like, you know, setting kind of like longer term goals and stuff and being a bit more like protective of myself. I think obviously, like, you know, in terms of like I was maybe a bit self-sacrificing when I was doing the project, and now I'm a bit more, I guess, more guarded with my time. Like, my time's very important, and I think I have nothing to prove to anyone anymore. I think there was a point where I felt like, and this is maybe what I said at the very top of the episode, saying about, like, you know, doing something from a space of positivity, where you're doing it kind of for yourself, or doing something from like a negative mind space where you're doing it despite others or to prove others wrong. And I'd really just encourage people to, you know, focus on yourself and don't compare yourself to others, because these days it's so easy to do that. Like, you know, you can see on social media, like, oh, someone like London's done this unbelievable magazine. Like, you don't know their circumstances, and they don't, like, you can only kind of benchmark against yourself, you know, like, you can only set goals for yourself and really strive to achieve them. And I think one of the best things about kind of generally goal setting or doing a project like Turf and Grain, like, I, you know, you plant a flag and you kind of charge for it, and you might not reach the flag, but you pick up so much along the way. Like, there's so many mistakes, or you fall down, or there's so many highs and lows, and like you go on the journey with people and you succeed with them. And honestly, it's been amazing that way. So yeah, I think it's just that sense of self and, you know, that kind of achievement of, you know, I've tried something for myself and I did it for myself. And it isn't like, okay, I'm 29, my life is now over. Like, it's never been like a sense of that. It's just maybe more like, I did go through a period when I announced the Turf was over that I kind of thought, like, you know, I felt like no creative urge whatsoever. I had nothing like that way. I was maybe just, my tank was maybe empty. But recently it's come back, you know, I'm writing a lot at the moment myself, and just like I have more surety in that. Like, I'm not insecure about my own writing anymore. Like, maybe that's not good. but, you know, I feel like I have a voice and I can use it, because I've already done it so many times and I've already helped so many other people do it. You know, I'm not excellent at that. So, I suppose you just grow a lot, but it's the mistakes. You can't be afraid to make mistakes. Like, you know, no one's perfect, and trying to be perfect is so unrealistic. It stops so many people doing anything, you know, that everything has to be perfectly ready before, like, it actually happens. Like, I'm not sure, like, loads of like French people like have really good English, but they're like totally afraid to say anything in English until like their English is perfect. But then you actually like, get them going and they're actually like unbelievable speaking English. It's kind of like that, you know, like you can only get yourself to a certain point of like knowledge in something before you have to dive in. And why I'd urge everyone to be like financially prudent. You know, you can do a lot for not a huge investment, you know, when there's so much opportunity. Like, look at the gaps in Northern Ireland between, like, you know, rich and poor, or like the two communities, like Protestant and Catholic, or between people who have like come from other, like, or even people who are like homeless or, you know, sleeping rough and stuff, and those who have, and people who come from other countries who are new. Like, there are so many opportunities and gaps to fill with interesting and important work. Like, there's so much opportunity, and just don't ever think that because you're in Belfast, you can't do that. Like, you know, like, Belfast is such a wonderful place. Northern Ireland is such a wonderful place to start stuff, because there's often you'll find that there's nothing like it here already. Mm. And, you know, if you have doubts about yourself, I'd just ask you to, you know, prove yourself wrong. And yeah, you know, I think there's so much opportunity, and I'd really, you know, urge people to try and just go for it, you know.
Mate, that is as good a place to end as any, I think.
Mm. Well, yeah, before we end, I just want to say, and don't cut this, I know what you're like, you'll probably cut this. But
let me just make a note of the timestamp here, 1 second.
Yeah.
102 but, minutes.
But yeah, like I've been looking forward to this chat, because, you know, it's one of those things when a project ends, and I'd say maybe the fear what people would have when a project ends or comes to its natural conclusion is it like they'll be like a different person or something, or like the kind of wall, the world's going to fall off a cliff or that kind of stuff. And I just want to say, you know, the opportunity to reflect on this properly for this discussion and for the chance to come back and discuss it, because so many people would appreciate that chance to come back, and it's maybe a little bit like therapy, if I'm honest, but to kind of talk through all the things that kind of ruminate in your head. I just want to say thank you to you for how valuable it is has been for me as a process to kind of think about it all again, because I think I was in maybe a head state where I was just trying to like move on from it. But to go back and reflect on it properly was a real gift. So I just want to thank you so much for giving me that gift. And yeah, I just really appreciate all you do with your podcast. Yeah. And don't cut that.
I can't now. You've bind me to it. I'm like, I'm in a bind. But yeah, mate, no, look, I'm so so chuffed to have you back, and really was so excited to do this and glad that we did. And I think I agree with you. Like, I think I'm trying to do a better job of celebrating past seasons and past versions of myself even. You know, I think, you know, you get into your mid-20s and you do that classic thing where you start to get a bit older, where you look back at like a 16-year-old version of yourself and you're like, oh, like what an idiot, or like how embarrassing, or like, you know. And I think we do the same with our own projects. You know, I look back at early episodes, or I look back at, you know, early things that I've published, and you're like, there is that temptation to be very critical. And I do think that is quite a Northern Irish thing, but that's a conversation for another time. And so I really wanted to do this because I also wanted just to honour you and say thank you for the incredible investment that you did pour into our community and what you did do for the creative community, because I think it was a tapping on the shoulder moment for a lot of creatives who were given a first opportunity or an early opportunity to do something and be a part of something really special. And those magazines, you know, you better submit them to the Ulster Museum, because they captured a moment in time. And I think it's important for us to look back on those things and for future generations to look back on things. And what a pleasure that they're so beautiful and enjoyable to look at. So you've made it easy for us.
Well, thanks a lot.
Awesome. Mate, you have to dash, do you?
Yeah, I do, unfortunately. I do have a wee doctor's appointment. Joy.
The joys, eh?
Yeah, but yeah, doctor's appointment. And then, yeah, I'm off today though, which is amazing. So I'm happy so excited. Days. So I'm going to go out and go take my mum for a wee walk and a coffee or something. I don't spend enough time with my mum, so she needs a bit of attention. so I'm going to go do that. I'm going to go invest the time in my mum, and she deserves it. And yeah, what are you doing today?
I have a interview after lunch. It's part of a new series on the climate. It's like a climate change series we're doing with Ulster Bank, actually. Which was
really
sweet. A wild card, but we were very happy for the opportunity.
No, that's great. And is that kind of thing? That's really good that you. I've seen you've done other kind of partnership kind of series and stuff, obviously. So
yeah, we're doing.
Is that something that's working for you?
It is working. Yeah, it's kind of like that editorial style of revenue where you're being commissioned to do what you do, just in a specific sort of like lens or angle. So like this week, we're rolling out a series with Belfast City Council, and it is a banging series. Like, it's so strong. Sweet. And it's all about businesses that started during the pandemic. So, you know,
that's unreal.
It's amazing to start to find opportunities to partner with people to leverage and amplify what you already want to do. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but I think it's also good. You know, it gives you a chance to also mix up your format as well. Like, you know, it's not.
Yeah, it's totally different.
The interviews are amazing, but it's just it's totally different.
You gotta keep it fresh.
I really, for example, the one about like Otto Jaffa was so sick. Like, I loved that one. Like, and it was different, and I really, the variety's good too. Is what I'm trying to say.
Variety's the spice of life, isn't it?
That's it. That's it. But here, look, genuinely, thank you so much.
Yes, mate. I do really appreciate it. Will play you in chess very soon?
You'll thrash me. I'll be studying.
Yeah, you're going to hit me. You're going to hit me with a Carol Khan. I'm going to be like, oh no, snap.
Yeah. You'll not know what's hit you.
See you, bro. Thanks for doing this.
Cheers, man. Chat to you later.
Bye bye. Awesome. Yeah, look, I've nothing else to say really, except for thank you so much for being here. Thoroughly enjoyed that time with Simon there, and I've been really looking forward to doing it, but also really wanting to do it for absolutely ages. And well, like, there is actually one more thing that I will say. I pulled this up while we were talking. You probably heard me type in there because I don't know it off by heart. Apologies. Just what Simon was saying at the end there, it just reminded me of, and this is a bit of a cliche in the kind of self-help personal development world, but we're going to ride the wave, so just buckle up. It's a quote by Theodore Roosevelt, Big Teddy. I think he was the Knight at Museum president. And he has a famous speech that's kind of goes under the name of the man in the arena. I'm just going to read this to end because I think it's very poignant and I think it's really important. It's not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, who comes short again and again, because there is no effort without error and shortcoming. But who does actually strive to do the deeds, who knows great enthusiasm, great devotion, and who spends himself in a worthy cause, at best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at the worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly. So his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who neither know victory nor defeat. There you go. I just went full US presidential on you there. Hope you have a good rest of your day. Thanks so much for being here. And look, if it is your first time, bestofbelfast.org. That's where you can find the other 200. Cheers.